This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Early this morning, the International Cycling Union, the sport's governing body, reported that the B sample taken from Tour de France winner Floyd Landis after stage 17 had confirmed high levels of testosterone. Phonak, the team for which Landis has been riding, announced his dismissal for violation of the team's internal code of ethics. Shortly after those announcements, cycling commentator Phil Leggett spoke to CNN about what Floyd Landis might do next.
He will contest it. He's hired a lawyer who specializes in this sort of athlete's problems with high testosterone rate, and his idea now will be to prove that he does produce it naturally.
In a statement posted early this morning on his website, Floyd Landis confirms he will, quote, fight these charges with the same determination and intensity that I bring to my training and racing. Landis has 10 days to appeal the ruling to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. He may appeal his case all the way to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. The Tour de France title will likely pass to Oscar Pereiro, who finished second in the event. In the summer of 1995, bungee jumping, sky surfing, and street luge joined 24 other action sports taking a shot at the big time. The success of the Extreme Games, as they were then known, surprised nearly everyone, including ESPN. X Games 12 are ongoing this week in Los Angeles, and the gnarliest sporting event currently ranks behind the Super Bowl, NBA Finals, and World Series as the fourth favorite sporting event for teenage boys. Marcus Donito, managing editor for Sports Business Daily, joins me now to talk about the growth of the X Games. Marcus, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
In the early years, the X Games had seven sponsors and all the athletes had day jobs. How different are things now?
Much different. I mean, a lot of these athletes are commanding, you know, in some cases, into the seven figures for endorsement deals. I mean, you're seeing a lot of blue chip type of companies sign on to this. They recognize it's a great way to reach a very young demographic. Probably, you know, males between the ages of 12 and 17 are the demographic that these advertisers are really trying to reach. So we've seen the X Games and some other extreme sport events, such as the action sports events like the Do Action Sports Tour, grow exponentially over the past decade.
Here's an interesting quote from the LA Times. Action sports remain focused on providing corporate sponsors and advertisers access to teenage males who seem immune to many advertising gambits. Does that focus on the sponsors instead of on the sport make the X Games different from, say, the Olympics?
Well, you know, I think events like this, in particular the X Games, are a way that advertisers can really make their first impressions on young males. I mean, we hear about the coveted demographic that advertisers are trying to reach. They're talking about males between the ages of 18 and 34. This demographic's a little younger. So this is an opportunity for advertisers to make their first impressions on those people, that demographic that's on the cusp of becoming the 18 to 34-year-old demographic. The reason why the advertisers covet that group is because they're typically not the people that are staying home to watch television. This is the opportunity for advertisers to really make their first impressions on those people that are eventually going to have a lot of money to spend. They're going to be difficult to reach. This is the means for them to do that.
Action sports like skateboarding, motocross, and surfing offer a sort of counterculture appeal. How much has the involvement of sponsors and television exposure changed that over the past few years?
It's certainly a balancing act, because part of the appeal of the X Games and action sports is sort of its edginess, its underground sort of culture. So advertisers, you know, broadcasters like ESPN need to be careful that they're really speaking to the audience they want to speak to and not becoming over-commercialized, because if they become over-commercialized and too corporate, that's really kind of flying in the face of what appeals to this audience. You know, they want it to be edgy. They want it to be sort of underground. So if you're kind of crossing that line and becoming too mainstream and too corporate, you know, that's not going to play well with the audience they're trying to reach.
EXPN, the website devoted to this event, is offering equal billing to interviews with, quote, favorite bands and action sports stars. Is this all more an entertainment spectacle than a sporting event?
Entertainment aspects play into it, but that's true across most sports now. I mean, most sports properties are realizing that, you know, they can extend their audience by adding some entertainment elements to it. I mean, look at the Super Bowl.
You Paul McCartney at the Super Bowl,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure. Or Janet Jackson, whoever. You know, you look at the NBA All-Star Game. You know, there's tons of entertainment elements around that. So I don't think that the X Games are really any different in that regard. It's just a way for sports to broaden their audience, to reach you know, different people than would normally tune in to see them only for the sport.
The X Games have legitimized a number of sports. Snowboarding, for example, was very popular at the most recent Winter Olympics, even among those who had been known to ridicule it. Can we expect to see more sports introduced into the mainstream via the X Games?
You know, that's a tough question to answer. We'll see. I mean, the X Games are continuing to tweak their events. They've added rally racing this year, for example. They're always sort of reevaluating what's playing well among the audience out there. The Olympics are keeping their eye on the X Games. If there are events that creep up and develop a following, I think the Olympics will take a closer look at those and consider adding them. But, you know, the Olympics are also mindful of how big they're becoming. So I'd be surprised to see a whole lot of additions on the Olympic roster.
Marcus Donito is the managing editor for Sports Business Daily. Marcus, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Preparations are underway for the 2006 college and pro football seasons. Linemen, quarterbacks, receivers, linebackers, and special team members all toil in the sweltering August heat. Recently, Beverly Amsler attended camp for a hot-footed group that subscribes to the axiom, those who can kick, those who can't teach kickers. She has this report.
The mercury in southwestern Virginia hovers around 90 degrees as a red-tailed hawk slowly circles above a makeshift football field. This field has only one goalpost, with uprights 8 feet apart instead of the official 18 feet. Six young men take turns kicking field goals. Their coach offers words of encouragement during this session of kicking camp. He moves from student to student, riding in a motorized wheelchair painted purple and gold with Vikings written on the back. Lifelong football fan Doug Blevins has cerebral palsy and has never kicked a football. He couldn't play because of his disability, but the Little League Football Organization in his hometown of Abingdon, Virginia, created a position called Junior Commissioner of the League so Blevins could participate.
I use the opportunity to learn from the coaches and learn football from the coaching perspective. And I found that when I got in high school, all the kids I was growing up with who was playing football, my knowledge of the game exceeded theirs.
He did film analysis for his high school football team. But to work in professional football, he knew he had to develop a specialty. So Blevins turned to his favorite team as a youngster, the Dallas Cowboys. In 1977, he wrote kicking coach Ben Akajanian a letter and asked for anything the coach could send him about the Cowboys' kicking game. And in return, the coach sent him a box of notes and other information that Blevins describes as magical.
Then I started, you know, applying what I learned. I could teach it, I could articulate it, I could see what guys were doing, I had an eye for it, and that turned into a passion, and that turned into a specialty.
During the 1990s, Blevins worked as a kicking coach for the New York Jets, Miami Dolphins, New England Patriots, Minnesota Vikings, and NFL Europe, then returned to his hometown in southwestern Virginia to start his own kicking camp. But how can someone who has never kicked a football teach others how to kick?
Well, I think it actually makes me a better coach because, see, so many kickers that try to coach try to teach you what they did, and each kicker is an individual. Yeah, they do something a little bit differently.
Blevins' clients have included Adam Vinatieri of the Indianapolis Colts, Chris Brown of the Houston Texans, Chris Hansen from the Jacksonville Jaguars, Kyle Roterson from the Cleveland Browns, and Shane Graham from the Cincinnati Bengals. Xavier Batia just signed with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Batia is just coming off his rookie season with NFL Europe, where he led the league most of the year. Batia found Blevins when his mom was looking for an agent to represent her son.
It's funny, the first 3 or 4 weeks, I was like, I don't know if this stuff worked. And they just clicked. You know what I mean? We were on the same page. And I was getting so much better, you know, at a point where I was like, how much better can you really get, you know? And it was amazing. It just sold me on it.
Batia says coach's advice was about things he would never have thought of.
you can't even compare the knowledge of the kicking game with any other coach. I mean, that I wouldn't even compare. I mean, I just think on the field he's not your babysitter, and he'll let you know the minute that you know you're messing up and the minute you're doing something wrong. He's not afraid to let you know, and I like that because, you know, we want somebody to be our friend, but on the field we want a coach. We don't want somebody to always tell us we're doing good. I think that's what makes him better than everybody else.
Blevins started working on Batia's kickoffs and field goal mechanics by changing his alignment, body position, point of contact, speed, and follow-through. Now he says he needs to get Batia to kick at a high level of consistency, something he's achieved with North Dakota kicker Jeff Glass.
I started working with Coach last April, actually, before my senior year. And this year I went 30 for 36 on field goals, which was the most field goals out of anybody in the country, regardless of the division.
Glass, who Blevins predicts will be a star NFL kicker, has worked out with the New York Giants and the Dallas Cowboys and is waiting for a call. When asked what he's learned from Coach, Glass replies, everything.
I've had other kicking coaches before, but nobody that breaks it down as good as Coach does. I've learned everything starting over. I mean, he takes stuff that you're good at and incorporates it into how he teaches you.
Blevins says it's rewarding to watch his students put what they've learned into practice because he knows all the work that went into making that field goal. He cites Adam Vinatieri as an example.
He had the game-winning kicks in the playoffs against Oakland in the snow, but we had done a lot of kicking in the snow here in Virginia. You know, a lot of kicking in the snow.
Blevins has branched out into sports management and is representing Batia as his agent. He wants to represent baseball players eventually. Blevins says he's living his dream.
I'm involved in professional sports every day, but yet it's my deal. It's my business, and I can, you know, watch it grow and don't have to worry about who's fired and so forth. And sit back during the seasons and watch the work that we did during the off year, see how everything unfolds. Nice. There you go, X. There you go, X. Nice.
Blevins says his ultimate goal would be to have every kicker in the NFL and Arena Football League as his clients. For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke, Virginia.
Nice, Jeff. Hey, Jeff, that wider base works a lot better. I like that.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, skating, passing, and checking all on one wheel. But first, the regional games leading to the 60th Little League World Series began yesterday. Beginning August 18th, the world's best teams of children 12 and under will play for the championship that has put Williamsport, Pennsylvania on the map. In his new book, Little League Big Dreams, Charles Eichner explores the delights and the dark side of the event. He joins me now from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Charles, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
For the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar with the teams competing in the Little League World Series, tell us a little bit about how the coaches assemble those teams.
The traditional way of assembling a team is for the winning manager of the championship team to pick who he thinks the best players are. There's some leagues that have the players select the teams also. But what's been happening in the last 10 years or so is that teams get developed over many years. So, for example, the champion from last year from Hawaii was assembled over a period of about 8 years by its manager, Leighton Oliviotto, and the team played not only in Little League but also in Pony League and the Cal Ripken League and also on a travel team. And the players got together as early as when they were 4 years old and learned how to play together and got drilled over many years. And so that's why they were so strong in the tournament last year. They were together for so long, and they play pretty much year-round, as most Sun Belt teams do.
4 years old?
Well, there were three players on the team that were cousins, and they started in T-ball together. And then those cousins grew up on various teams, and they eventually ended up being the core of the infield that won the Little League World Series last year.
When you decided to write about the Little League World Series, did you assume that the story would be mostly about kids having fun?
I assumed that it was going to be a mixed bag. I think that all things in America these days and all things about childhood these days have some really positive, glimmering moments. But there's also a lot of over-organization going on, whether you're talking about baseball or football or the local band or whatever it might be. And so I assumed that there were some of that. And what I assumed was pretty much what I got. But what I really didn't expect as much is to feel the range of emotions that I felt when I got to know some of these players. I mean, and their managers and their families also. They were all, for the most part, you know, emotionally invested in this thing, and their levels of maturity varied, but they cared so much about it, and it's hard not to care about people that care about something so much.
Charlie, I wasn't surprised to find stories in your book of parents behaving badly at the Little League World Series. I was a little surprised that one of the worst offenders was a former major leaguer. Tell us about Coach Dante Bichette in Williamsport.
Well, you know, I have to say that Dante was both the good and the bad. He was a sweet guy. He gave me a lot of time. We spent time together. He taught me how he coached his kids, and, you know, he really throws a lot of his heart into it. But like a lot of parents and a lot of coaches, when things get on the line and when there's a possibility of being eliminated and when you see something that you think is wrong and you want to get in there and do something about it, and in the game against California, when Florida was eliminated from the Little League World Series, Dante thought that the California kids were stealing signs, which, as we know, is a part of baseball, although maybe it shouldn't happen that early. And so Dante started to really kind of bring it to the kids on the California team. He started to kind of shout at them and try to intimidate them, the pitcher and the catcher. And
all right, he's intimidating 12-year-olds.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked Dante about that afterwards. I said, well, why were you yelling at those kids? And he said, well, in the big leagues, when somebody's stealing signs, what we do is we brush them off the plate. And we can't do that because they're kids, and so our only recourse for kind of correcting this situation is to shout at them and intimidate them and also intimidate their managers. I think it really points to the major problem with Little League, and in fact all organized sports, is that when the parents feel like they have to take control of a situation, it ceases to be a kid's game, and it becomes really a contest of wills of other people for other purposes.
Once the 2005 Little League World Series had come down to Hawaii and Curaçao, you maintained that it earned the distinction of the greatest World Series ever played. How so?
Well, it was only the second World Series championship game that went into extra innings, and you had a defending champion going against a team, a representative of a state that had never made it to the finals before. And to me, the great thing about it was the comeback. Hawaii was down by 3 runs in the last inning, and they rallied, and then they won it with a walk-off home run. And even though I would not want to raise my kids to play on a team like Hawaii, it was just a little too intense for me, too much of a commitment, not enough of good old-fashioned exploration of childhood, which is what I think it should be all about. I love these Hawaiian people. They were as gentle and nice and family-oriented as any people I've ever met. And so I was really happy to see them rally, and they took such delight in what they did.
Seems to me that you have a real balancing act here, because by making the assertion that 2005 was the greatest World Series ever played, you may fall into that category of people who take the Little League World Series too seriously. Do you worry about that at all?
It's a really interesting question, because when you are in Williamsport, you cannot help but get drawn into the drama and the excitement. It's a really wonderful setting in so many ways. I went with my photographer and her 2 kids, and it was the only place that we can ever remember just telling the kids, run along now, you can do whatever you want, and not really worrying about it. She had a long lens, and so she could kind of spy them on the hill once in a while and make sure everything was going okay. But it's really a wonderful scene, and I think what you have to realize about Little League and a lot of youth sports for that matter is that it's truly 2 sides of the coin. You know, I quote Keats early in the book talking about this concept of negative capability. You have to be able to have 2 completely opposing ideas and keep them in your mind at the same time. And I think that's really what Little League is all about. It's about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I don't think we should lose sight of the good just because we're concerned about the bad and the ugly.
Running throughout Little League Big Dreams is a refrain that suggests that lots of adults remember that they had more fun playing pickup games with no adult supervision at all than they did playing organized ball, even those who played Little League, Babe Ruth, the whole package.
Right.
Do you think that's still the case with kids today?
I think it is. You know, to me, one of the really kind of moving moments in the Little League World Series last year was in this friendship game that the Florida team played against Venezuela. After both teams were eliminated from the series, literally gives them the opportunity to just play games that don't count. And by their own accounts, they had much more fun playing that pickup game than they did when they were in the middle of the intensity of the series. And the bottom line is that it's terrific to introduce kids to things, and having a formal organization to do that is not such a bad idea either. But in some way or other, you have to let go and let kids be kids. And I think there are so many parents that are so intent on their kids developing the right way, quote unquote, that they won't let kids explore and make mistakes. And to me, that's the central thing that childhood should be all about.
Charles Eichner is the author of Little League Big Dreams, subtitled The Hope, the Hype, and the Glory of the Greatest World Series Ever Played, published by Sourcebooks. He joined me from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Charlie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Last week in Switzerland, the best hockey teams from more than a dozen countries around the world displayed their mettle at a hard-fought tournament played not on skates, but on unicycles. Recently, Judith Ritter visited one unicycle hockey team, the feisty Uniwheelers from Hong Kong, at one of its practices, and she has our report.
Here in a working-class neighborhood of Hong Kong, in a cement playground squeezed between two noisy major streets, Hong Kong's unicycle hockey warriors battle it out, sticks clashing, chrome wheels flashing, oblivious to the bursts of rain that drench the city this time of the year. At first glance, unicycle hockey looks like a cross between a circus act and street hockey. Decked out in bicycle shorts, helmets, and knee pads, the players, men, women, even kids from about 7 to 17, balance high up on bicycle seats. They clutch hockey sticks and pedal their one-wheelers wildly, all the while trying to smack a street hockey ball at one of the nets at either end of the court. Throughout, they shout to each other in English and in Cantonese. They skid, they fall off, they hop back on, and then they resume the chase.
So go for it! Here, back in the defense. Come.
It's 8 at night, and the temperature's in the 80s. The players' shirts, some red, some blue, are dark with sweat. Some of the athletes drop out for water. The game looks dangerous, exciting, and, well, a bit silly. You'd have to have some major affection for either unicycling or hockey to want to do this.
So, you know, work takes second place to unicycle hockey in my life.
Don't get Martin Turner wrong. He loves his marketing job. There's just something short of transcendent about this sport that's kept him coming out on Monday nights for the last 4 years.
The whole process is enjoyable. I mean, every moment, every 10 minutes, every half an hour, you can feel the improvement. You feel yourself being that much more steady, or going slightly further, or being able to control a turn, or eventually, woo, you know, go backwards, or uphill, or downhill, or any other weird things that you pick up.
Unicycle hockey is played in at least a dozen countries, and it has been since the 80s. Germany and Switzerland have national teams, and for some odd reason, Minneapolis and Memphis are American uniwheeler hotspots. The game has only been played about 4 years in Hong Kong, but already has its serious devotees. It also has a surprisingly broad appeal, even caught the fancy of a unicycle hockey version of a soccer mom, Jenny Ma. After several years of bringing her two teens to practice, a fortuitous shortage of players was her good luck.
One of the players asked me, how about you also play, you also ride unicycle so that we can play together. So, okay, I just learned. Actually, it's a very difficult game. You know, you have to ride, and at the same time, you have to take the ball, you have to hold a stick, at the same time, you have to ride faster. When I ride, I'm afraid of falling down. So, must be careful.
5-5, okay.
Players ride dangerously fast. They tip sideways, almost parallel to the ground when taking turns, and they ride backwards. They fall down and get up over and over again. There's none of that body checking that you see in ice hockey. In fact, high-sticking, pushing, poking someone's wheel with a stick are all illegal. But if you like a blood sport, you got it. At least when it comes to learning the basics.
I do have bruises, black and blues, edemas, cuts, blood spurting here and there, just from trying to learn the unicycle.
That's David Palmer, originally from Utah. By day, a quiet librarian at a university in Hong Kong. By night, a warrior in training.
What's the hardest thing about this?
Balance. You might be able to ride it in the beginning, which takes some time, but then it takes a further time to learn how to turn, and then after that, a further time to learn how to stand still in one spot, and then maybe to go backwards on it. It's a progression.
Palmer hasn't only overcome his wounds, but like all the players in this strange sport, he's had to deal with the raised eyebrows of bosses and work colleagues in conservative, work-driven Hong Kong.
They thought that to ride a unicycle, I had to wear those big, long, floppy clown shoes and to wear a big red nose.
This weekend in Switzerland, unicycle hockey honchos will be out to prove this is more than a clown sport. In the last world competition, Hong Kong placed ninth in a field of 11. Figuring they need just a bit more practice, they've decided to sit this round out. But look for their wheels on fire in 2008. For Only a Game, I'm Judith Ritter.
You're listening to Only a Game. A listener in Kansas City who signed his email Forrester has been unhappy with Only a Game's most recent coverage of his favorite sport. A few weeks ago, I was very excited to hear your angle on the new post-Lance Tour de France, he wrote, and you said nothing. Then the worst thing happened. The cycling community is crushed, and who all of a sudden shows up? Only a Game finds 7 minutes for a headline story. I get it, Only a Game. People suck. Thanks for opening my eyes. Keith Kotler, who hears the program on KSUT in Durango, Colorado, was unhappy with the answer Charlie Pierce came up with when I asked him last week about driver Juan Pablo Montoya's move from Formula One racing to NASCAR. The answer Pierce gave was so far from accurate that I could only roll my eyes and wince, Mr. Kotler wrote. He went on to maintain that Montoya hadn't been able to cut it in Formula One racing and to urge Charlie, please don't make the mistake that so many of our politicians make and assume that anything outside of this country is irrelevant. NASCAR is a very small player in the world of auto sport and will never reach the status of Formula One. Jill Livengood, who says Charlie makes her, quote, hoot with laughter, wrote to say she was captivated by the story about former Negro League baseball player Tony Stone that was provided by commentator Martha Ackman, who's writing a book about Ms. Stone. Sorry, Ms. Livengood, the writing is still in progress and the book won't be available for some time, but you can learn more at Ms. Ackman's website, marthaackman.com. And now to a WBUR listener.
Hi, the name is Jim Alford. I just heard that bit of nonsense about motocross on Bill Littlefield's show. It was hazardous not only to the drivers, but the spectators. And really a bit of disgusting broadcasting. Please refrain from this non-sports nonsense in the future.
Carol Barger of Orchard Park, New York, has a son who participated in that road rally, not motocross, in Maine. Ms. Barger loved Karen Given's story and wrote to find out how she could get a copy of it. She and you can do so by calling 1-800-909-9287. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. We're also reachable at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, kayaking out to the old fishing hole. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Thursday, the U.S. men's national basketball team dispatched Puerto Rico with ease. It was only an exhibition game, of course, but is the U.S. back?
Well, it's already, you know, testimony to Coach K's genius, and we're not anywhere near Beijing yet, so I'm pretty amazed. It was the kind of game that other U.S. teams would have sort of fumbled their way through. They didn't start very well, but they really put on a finishing kick, and they really closed the deal very well. And, you know, people like Antoine Jameson, who you wouldn't think of as one of the elite players in the NBA, although he's had a tremendous career. He had 16 points. He's going to be very valuable. I mean, they went 31-2 from the end of the first half to the beginning of the second half. So, yes, it's a good sign considering they lost to the same Puerto Rican team by 19 points in the last Olympics.
The National Basketball Association was apparently listening when a lot of people expressed dissatisfaction with the seeding format for the 2006 postseason. How have those running the league improved matters?
Well, they've managed to put the top four seeds, which are the three division winners and the second-place team with the best record, get seeded according to win-loss total and not according to where you finish. So you will not have a situation like you had this year where San Antonio had played Dallas earlier in the process than they should have.
This week's record heat has been headline news, of course, across the country, Charlie. Saratoga, Monmouth Park, and Delaware Park were among the thoroughbred tracks that canceled racing Wednesday because it was just too hot. This means I could have had my best day ever at the track if I'd gone out there on Wednesday.
Yes, you could have merely passed out and your insurance would have covered you. It's really astonishing to me. I can't speak for Monmouth or Delaware Park because I've never been to either one. But I've been to Saratoga, and the idea of it being too hot to race at Saratoga is astonishing to me. Saratoga always impresses me as, like, the place where the cool breezes come from.
NFL teams have been holding preseason practice early.
Two-a-days, baby!
Two-a-days, but early in the morning.
What do you think these guys are, those pansy-ass racehorses?
Yeah, but early in the morning and late at night. So maybe the league finally is acknowledging that practice in the heat of August midday is a serious threat to players.
Yeah, I like the notion of practicing under the lights is just a great thing. Yeah, Corey Stringer's death, the heat-related problems they have, these are very large men, many of whom are being asked to do things that test the limits of their physical ability on the best of days, having them do it in 106 degrees. I was at Cowboy training camp one time in Wichita Falls, Texas, and I guarantee you I was hotter there than I was when I was in Qatar. So, yes, I think this is a good idea.
His responsibilities regarding practice prevented Miami Dolphins head coach Nick Saban from accepting a dinner invitation from President Bush. So, will Coach Saban's tax returns get a very careful look over the next few years?
Well, actually, it's funny. Defensive end Jason Taylor, who we'll see has been having his own problems of late, also turned out a chance to go because the dinner conflicted with team meetings. I'm too busy with my football team, Mr. President. I'm sorry. Wow.
I wonder also if one of the things Coach Saban is so busy with is concern over whether the Dolphins' locker room is, in fact, going to be the setting for a soap opera this season.
Yeah, Jason Taylor, as I mentioned before, has his own problems. He is being divorced from the sister of his teammate, Zach Thomas. Jason Taylor has said it's ridiculous that we'd think it. We're professionals. Yes, lots of professionals go through divorces, and it works, and it does not end well. You know, I hope everybody involved is happy, but to say it might not affect the locker room is being a bit naive, I would say.
The shades of the New York Yankees of some decades ago. Didn't that go through something like that?
Well, so did the Boston Red Sox in what we laughingly refer to now as the Margo Adams era.
The Black Coaches Association has asked the NCAA to expand the ban on NCAA championship events, which had already been imposed on South Carolina, in part because South Carolina still displays the Confederate flag on the State House. The current ban has been in place for 6 years. Will expanding it have any particular effect?
I'm not sure. I was caught in the middle of this a couple of years ago when United States Fencing Association had its Summer National Championships in Greenville, and there was some talk about that, but, you know, fencing the fencing universe being one of the more oblivious ones in the wild string theory of sports, paid such close attention that a year later they had a North American Cup tournament in Greenville on Martin Luther King Day weekend.
Oops.
So people are sort of not paying attention. I don't know. I mean, good for the Black Coaches Association flexing its muscle on this issue. Will it have any effect? I have no idea.
Meanwhile, in North Carolina, the State Historical Commission was not especially upset when somebody dressed a lot of statues there in Carolina Hurricanes jerseys. But Davis Jones was outraged. Did he have a point?
No. Do you think Andrew Jackson sitting majestically on his horse while wearing a Hurricanes jersey was awe-inspiring and thought-provoking? Guess what? You could put Andrew Jackson himself on that horse and let him stand there, and he wouldn't be awe-inspiring and thought-provoking. Get a life. Lighten up. I think Old Hickory would have come down personally and shot the guy who put the jersey on.
In the great tradition of players on teams that aren't going to win anything, Jeff Cirillo of the Milwaukee Brewers has come up with an explanation for why his team doesn't score much at Coors Field. Do you accept his reasoning, Charlie?
Well, Coors Field and having baseball in Denver has always been an interesting proposition due to the altitude and the thin air and the way the ball carries. Oddly enough, it was Milwaukee who used to have a minor league team there and could never trust any of the scouting they got on either their power hitting phenoms or their young pitchers, because you had to adjust for the ridiculous atmosphere. So now we have a Milwaukee infielder named Jeff Cirillo saying that they're waterlogging the balls at Coors Field so they won't carry quite as far.
People often ask me which sports championship I would most like to attend, Charlie, and now I would have an answer, except that the public isn't allowed to go to the World Championship of Magic. What? Are they afraid we'll figure out the tricks?
Why do I get the feeling that, like, Penn and Teller are across town digging a tunnel into this thing and secreting cameras into the meeting rooms? But it's followed by 2,500 magicians from as far away as Macau and the Virgin Islands who have gone to Stockholm. The championship's been going on since 1948, and it's lately been held every 3 years. I wonder what you went
for.
I would pay to go. I would swear myself to secrecy. And I just wonder what you get for a trophy and whether or not you are thereupon obligated to make it disappear.
On the other hand,
I have no
interest in attending the first annual World Strip Poker Championship, even though it's going to transpire in London, which is a city that I like a good deal. I would point out that competitors are not necessarily going to look real great when they lose.
Well, this is the point. I have watched the World Series of Poker, and I've also watched English soccer.
Well,
and the combination of all of those folks that I've seen at both events getting naked is truly freaking scary.
Precisely my point. A new bridge in Hungary may soon be named the Chuck Norris Bridge. Does this say something about Hungary or about Chuck Norris or perhaps about me for bringing
Chuck
this matter
Norris,
up as if it were related to sports?
Chuck Norris could eat Hungary. Before
and
breakfast.
Still be hungry.
Before breakfast and still have room for most of Romania.
And finally, Charlie, bad news for lovers of spicy Mexican sausage. The chorizo, which had been added to the wildly popular sausage races at Milwaukee's Miller Park, has been sent down to the minors for, wait for it, seasoning.
So are they bringing up one of their young and promising bratwursts to step in or not? I would like to point out for the record that my old Marquette Tribune colleague Don Walker, who works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, broke the sending down the chorizo story.
And
I'd like to send props out to Doker for having done that.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He brings his seasoned perspective to his upcoming book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Chuck Norris has tantrums bigger than me.
In the eyes of a ranger, the unsuspecting stranger had better know the truth of wrong from right.
If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast.
Texas left behind you, 'cause that's where the Rangers gonna be.
The kayak has been in use for at least 4,000 years, or ever since indigenous people living in Arctic regions thought their sleek craft could help them find food. In his never-ending quest to get closer to fish, modern man has taken to the kayak. In the last several years, the popularity of kayak fishing has soared in North America, sometimes in decidedly sub-Arctic climes. Only a Game's John Kalish set out among the faithful and filed this report.
In a warehouse in Mine Hill, New Jersey, kayaks are being retrofitted with fishing rod holders. The finished kayaks are then wrapped in sheets of bubble wrap and shipped to their proud new owners. This is the headquarters for KayakFishingStuff.com, which sells everything from bare-bones kayaks to nearly $2,000 pedal-powered kayaks that come equipped with rudders, fish finders, and global positioning systems. John Shine is an avid fisherman and a co-owner of KayakFishingStuff.com.
Basically, the sport started where guys on the West Coast were using surfboards to go fishing, and somebody had the bright idea, oh, let's try a kayak instead. When I started kayak fishing 8 years ago, there were only a handful of us. We all knew one another by name. But over probably the last 5 years, it's really grown, and every year it's logarithmic, the growth.
Close to 200 people participated in a spring kayak fishing tournament in Jamaica Bay near New York City's Kennedy Airport. Among them was Paul Schultz, an editor at the New York Daily News who kayak fishes with his wife.
The thing I like about kayak fishing is you get right up next to the fish. You have a sort of a stealth factor with the kayak. There's no loud motor. It's not a big profile in the water. It's a narrow, small profile, and it's noiseless. The other thing about kayaks I like is that they can go in shallow water. You can't take a boat in 1, 2, 3 feet of water. It's really tricky to do that. But kayaks, that's perfect. And there's a lot of great fishing in shallow water.
Sometimes great fishing is found just beyond a fisherman's cast. That's been the experience of Artie Wehrhahn, a 59-year-old film archivist who lives in Greentown, Pennsylvania. Wehrhahn has been fishing for more than 40 years. He used to fish exclusively from the Jersey Shore until he started noticing people fishing from kayaks, at which point he became waterborne.
You'd see some fish breaking and chasing bait fish just out of reach of your furthest cast, and it's very frustrating, and sometimes it'd go on for an hour or more even. The great thing about having these lightweight kayaks is you can have one on the roof of your car or vehicle and just put it in the water, get your paddle, get your life jacket and a rod, and go out and get them.
On a sunny weekday morning, Stephen Mosca pushes me into Split Rock Reservoir before jumping into the tandem kayak we have borrowed for the day. Mosca is an avid cyclist who commutes to work on a $4,000 cycle. He usually pedals his Hobie kayak for fishing, but today he's paddling around the huge reservoir, which is surrounded by a thick forest of green trees.
This reservoir is the primary source of water for the city of Newark, which is about 20, 30 miles away from here. The water in this reservoir is pretty deep. It runs 80 to 100 feet deep. The water is extremely clean and cold.
Kayak fishermen can tire from the effort it takes to paddle back to where they want to be after being pushed by the wind. Some of them use small anchors to avoid drifting. It was windy the day Mosca and I were out after pike and largemouth bass.
Fish usually want to stay, and I know this for a fact because I've communicated with fish on a few occasions. They like to stay in the shallow sections where maybe an insect might fall off a tree or a worm might fall off a tree or something might spill over from a rainstorm. There are times where I just get out of the kayak, and it just serves as a platform for me for my supplies. And I'll lynch it to my waist, and I'll just walk in the shallows or the flats, and I'll do a lot of wading and fishing.
We spend a few hours on the reservoir, but Mosca barely gets a nibble.
It's lunchtime for these guys. They're probably napping. Again, I know this for a fact. They're napping at this point.
Down in Florida, the fish are obviously wide awake and eager to go after both artificial lures and live bait. At least that's how they are in the how-to videos produced by Ken Daubert, a veteran fishing guide who runs a website called FloridaKayakFishing.com. Daubert says kayak fishing is poised for explosive growth, especially for freshwater fishing.
Think about it as a grassroots wildfire, and it's fueled by the internet. It's really just at the very beginning. The bass fishermen haven't yet discovered this kind of fishing, and bass fishing is the most popular fishing in America. So when those people catch on, every pond in America is going to have kayaks launching on it to go specifically fishing for bass, bluegills, pickerel, pike. They don't have any idea about what's going on with this yet.
Daubert can be seen in his DVD, Kayak Fishing for Bass, paddling around in a kayak and hauling in one largemouth bass after another.
That's a big fish. Big fish. Oh, yeah. There he is, baby. Oh, yeah. Now that's a big bass there. That's a big boy.
They caught some big boys at the kayak fishing tournament in Jamaica Bay this spring. The winner was a 36-inch striped bass. Jeff Lopez caught a huge weakfish the day before the tournament. Lopez is a plumber from Winthrop, Massachusetts, and as far as he's concerned, there's no other way to fish. Lopez has been kayak fishing for 5 years, ever since he saw commercial fishermen in Mexico catching red snappers from kayaks. Lopez often takes his yak out in Boston Harbor.
Once you go yak, you'll never go back. It's an experience in itself. I mean, it's not just the fishing, it's the camaraderie in the sport. Brotherhood is probably a good way to describe it.
And why is that?
I think we're unique, getting in a 12 or 15-foot piece of plastic and, going out and fishing. And you can have intimate gatherings on the water, whereas you can't get 10 boats together. We can huddle up together in an area and, kind of razz each other and, say, hey, I outfish you and all that kind of stuff.
And that's what you do?
Oh, that's what we do. We have a blast.
In September, kayak fishermen will gather for a tournament in La Jolla, California at the height of yellowtail season. Another kayak fishing tournament will take place in Malibu, California in November. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Oh, he's right under me. Right under the kayak.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Simon Wood and from Stu Kennedy at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Little League Big Dreams, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Only a Game's Charlie Pierce as he browses through a stack of all the sports news fit to broadcast.
All right, so the ping pong champ is not a steroid thing. We're good to go.
That's too bad. If there are two sports stories Charlie loves, it's ping pong and steroids. Put the two together, radio magic. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.